because of what his brother Amnon had done. And we saw how all that came about and how Absalom had Amnon killed. And then somebody started the rumor that he had actually killed all of David's sons. And that word somehow got back to David, and of course he got very upset. You see there in verse 31, his servants got upset. But then Jonadab speaks up and says that what he's heard is not true, that not all of his sons were dead, but just Amnon, and declares that it was by the appointment of Absalom, and how he had determined to do this from the day that Amnon had forced his sister Tamar. And that's really how it was. Once Absalom heard what was done, he immediately began to plan his revenge. And it took over 2 years, but he finally worked it out to where he was able to do what he intended to do, which was end Amnon's life. But we see in verse 33, where we pick up today, where Jonadab continues to speak to David, and he says, "Now therefore let not my lord the king take the thing to his heart, to think that all the king's sons are dead, for Amnon only is dead." He's telling David that he doesn't need to listen to what he's heard. Don't take that serious, because that's not how it happened. Only Amnon is dead. Obviously, losing one son would cause you grief, or one child would cause you grief, but it wouldn't cause as much grief as if you had several children and all of your children died. But he's telling him here, you don't need to listen to this, because that's not what has happened. And it says in verse 34, but Absalom fled. So he runs when he has Amnon killed, because he probably fears for his life. He probably thinks that once David finds out, then he may be dealt with harshly, even put to death himself, which actually is what should have happened to Absalom. In the Old Testament, it was an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a life for a life. If a person shed man's blood, then their blood was to be shed. That's how it was in the Old Testament. And even as you come on into the New Testament, Paul and other writers teach capital punishment to still be in effect, even under the New Covenant. So Absalom should have died. Was what Amnon did to his sister bad? Absolutely. It was a horrible, terrible thing, and there's no doubt that it should have been punished. It should have been dealt with. But he should not have taken matters into his own hands and killed him. What he did actually was murder. He just had the man murdered because he was mad about what he did to his sister. And I'm sure all of us in here would have felt the same way to some extent had somebody done something like that to one of our family members. But just because you have certain feelings and emotions and things that you want to do doesn't necessarily mean that it's right to do. You understand that principle? And just because one person does wrong doesn't mean you are entitled to do wrong. You've heard, I know many times before, that two wrongs never make a right. Well, that's correct. So just because somebody in wickedness does something horrible and hellish does not give you or me or anybody the right to take matters into our own hands and think that we're above the law and do whatever we want to do. We are not supposed to do that. We're to allow the law to be, you know, to take care of the situation. But Absalom didn't do that. And he's running because he's scared that he's going to get it. But if you look again at verse 34, it says, and the young man that kept the watch lifted up his eyes. This is the young man that would be keeping watch there over the city. It's going to be somebody that's up in a tower or on the wall or something, just keeping their eye out. All cities had this. They had somebody that was like a watchman, somebody that constantly was there to watch out for enemies and people that might be coming against the city. So this young man, he lifts up his eyes and looked, and behold, there came much people by the way of the hillside behind him. Sees a big crowd of people heading that way. And Jonadab said unto the king, behold, the king's sons come, as thy servant said, so it is. He said, look, I told you that it wasn't all your sons that got killed. And that's what happening here, you're seeing your sons are coming back to you. And that's what I said. The thing about this Jonadab you got to remember is early on in this chapter, we were told that he was a subtle man. Y'all remember that? Very slick and crafty, a tricky type fella. And he is actually the one, you remember, that helped Amnon come up with the plan to do what he did to Tamar. Y'all remember that? David doesn't know this. And Jonadab does not, if you notice, ever speak up and take any responsibility for what has happened here. He's just talking to the king and acting like he's the king's buddy and trying to encourage the king, you know, not all your sons are dead, just one of them's dead, and trying to give himself some type of credibility with the king. Like there in the verse, he says, as thy servant said, so it is. Like, you know, I'm a man of my word. You can trust me. You can give me confidence. And really all Jonadab's doing is just trying to find favor in the eyes of the king. It's a selfish thing. He's looking to get some type of promotion or favor from the king. When had he been an honest man and said, look, I'm really the one responsible for this whole gigantic mess here. I'm the one that told Amnon what to do. What would have happened to him likely? Absalom killed him. Nothing happened until Absalom took matters into his own hands, which, by the way, was wrong of David. See, in this whole thing here, David does not handle things the way he should have handled them. When he found out what his son had done, he should have stepped up as the king and done something right then. He should have, but he didn't. Probably because that was his son. Oftentimes people make exception for their family, don't they? I mean, that's the reality of life. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. That was Amnon's half sister. Yeah. Yeah, that's his daughter. Mm-hmm. And David definitely should have punished Amnon for what he did. There's no question. But he for whatever reason, David didn't. The only explanation I can think of is that it's his son. Maybe he just didn't want to be harsh with his son. And again, you see that oftentimes where people will be harsh on others, but they make exception for their own family, and they sort of give their family a pass, especially if it's their children. You know, if their children do something wrong, if it was somebody else's child, they would think they needed their hide nailed to the wall, wouldn't they? But if it's my son or my daughter, then we begin to sort of make excuse and try to figure out some way to, you know, that's just how people are. Is that right? No, never is that right, never. But that's just kind of how people are. And I guess because David never did anything, Absalom figured, all right, I'll take care of it. And he did. But what he did wasn't right either. He didn't handle that situation right. But again, this Jonadab here, he's the one that concocted the whole scheme, set the thing in motion, but he doesn't disclose that to David. He keeps that close because he knows he'd be in trouble, and now he's trying to get some kind of favor and credibility with the king. I said all that to say this, Jonadab was a sorry individual, okay? I mean, if you just want to lay it out in good old plain English, he was a sorry, worthless individual. The only person that really mattered to him was himself, just a selfish man looking to advance himself in whatever way he could. So he's just not a good guy. But anyway, verse number 36, and it came to pass as soon as he had made an end of speaking, that behold, the king's sons came and lifted up their voice and wept. So all the boys are back, and they're with their dad, and they're all upset, and they're crying. They're upset because their brother's been killed. And the king also and all his servants wept very sore. The thing is, I don't believe that any of these other sons knew what Amnon had done. Because if you look at verse 20 in this chapter, It says, "And Absalom, her brother, said unto her, unto Tamar, Hath Amnon thy brother been with thee? But hold now thy peace, my sister. He is thy brother. Regard not this thing." So Tamar remained desolate in her brother Absalom's house. It's hard to imagine that they didn't know, but, you know, he tells her to just keep her mouth shut, don't say anything. So it's possible that the other brothers didn't know. Verse 21, David found out. He knew what was going on. Somehow word got to him. See, it may have gotten to the other brothers, but it doesn't say that they knew anything about it. And now they're back, and they're all upset because of what happened. And it says at the end of verse 36, "And the king also and all his servants wept very sore." And then verse 37, "But Absalom fled and went to Talmai, the son of Ammihud, the king of Geshur. And David mourned for his son every day." Well, Absalom flees, and he goes to a particular place. He doesn't just pick any random place to go to. Where he goes is to family. He actually goes to be with his mother's family. That's where Absalom goes. Hold your place here and go to 1 Chronicles. 1 Chronicles. Chapter 3. This will show you that Absalom was very specific in where he went. Like I say, he didn't just pick out somewhere to go and wind up there. He had a specific location in mind. He went to his mother's side of the family and sought refuge with them. 1 Chronicles chapter 3, in the first verse, it starts talking about the sons of David. And when you get to verse 2, it says that David's third son was Absalom, the son of Maacah, the daughter, you see this, the daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur. Well, where'd he go? He went to Talmai, the son of Ammihud, king of Geshur. And it was his daughter, Maacah, that David had married, and together they had had Absalom. So he goes to his mother's side of the family, as I said, to seek refuge. When did David get with Maacah? When did they hook up and get married? Well, if you go back to 1 Samuel now, 1 Samuel chapter 27, I can at least give you an idea of when that happened. 1 Samuel chapter 27. First Samuel chapter 27, and this is all the way back when David's still on the run from Saul and that stuff where he's having to live out in the wilderness in different places. At the time here, he's actually down in the land of the Philistines. But while he's there, look at what it says in verse number 8. Verse number 8. "And David and his men went up and invaded the Geshurites." See that? The Geshurites. "And the Gezrites and the Amalekites, for those nations were of old the inhabitants of the land, as thou goest assured, even unto the land of Egypt." So while he's on the run from Saul, him and his men invade Geshur. Now, it doesn't say specifically that that's when he took Talmai's daughter, Maacah, but I guess that's about as good a time as any for that to happen. He probably went in there and took her, and she became his wife, and anyway, they had Absalom. So when Absalom gets on the run, he goes to his family. He goes to his mother's side of the family to seek refuge. And if you look back in 2 Samuel 13 now, again in verse 37, it says at the end of that verse, "And David mourned for his son every day." That's talking about Amnon, not Absalom at this point. He's mourning for Amnon because obviously he's been killed. He's lost a son, and every day he's mourning, at least for some time. And notice the time that lapses here, verse 38. "So Absalom fled and went to Geshur and was there 3 years." So for 3 years he takes refuge with his mother's side of the family. But in verse 39 you see it says, "The soul of King David longed to go forth unto Absalom, for he was comforted concerning Amnon, seeing he was dead. So after some time passes, you know, he's mourned, but after some time passes, and, you know, the old saying is time heals all wounds. I don't know that time completely heals all wounds, but I do think that time allows you to mourn and do whatever it is you got to do to where you can handle the situation better. We'll put it like that. You may not ever fully get over the thing, but you do at least get, as time goes by, where it's not as raw on you. It's easier to deal with. And that's what happens with David. In the beginning, obviously, he's very upset about his son being killed, but as time passes, he gets beyond that, and then he starts longing for his son Absalom. He wants to see him. And again, you have to look at this situation, understand that David's just not handling this thing right. First of all, David obviously knew, and I don't know how he knew, but somehow he knew where his son was. You know what that means? That means he could have went down there and got him. And he could have punished Absalom for what he did. So first of all, he doesn't punish Amnon for what he did. And now he's got a son, Absalom, who's murdered his brother, and he doesn't even punish him. He doesn't do anything to him. He knows where he's at, and he just lets him stay down there for those 3 years. But there comes a point where David begins to want to go to where he's at. Notice it doesn't say that David longed for him to come to him. It says he longed to go forth unto Absalom. Why would David not want him to come? If he wanted to see him, couldn't he just send down there and have him brought back? Which, in fact, happens in the next chapter. But he doesn't do that. And I think David is strategic in that. He doesn't want him brought back because, one, he knows if he brings him back, then he's going to be there and potentially he's going to have to deal with this situation, and knows that there might be some people that would take vengeance on him, that would be upset with Absalom for what he did and kill him. There's probably a lot of different thoughts that David's having about it, so he just figures, okay, the best case scenario is just leave him where he's at. He's down there. Nobody's messing with him. Let's just leave the situation as it is. Don't upset the apple cart is the idea. Just leave it like it is. So he wants to go, but he doesn't. And that brings us to the next chapter where we actually have Absalom brought back. And this thing with Absalom is only going to get worse. Absalom is a bad person. And one person I read behind suggested that perhaps Absalom was the kind of fella he was because of how his mother was. As you think about his mama, her name's Maacah. She's the daughter of a heathen king. So she's not brought up in a godly home, in a godly environment. She's not raised the way David and other people were. And perhaps she had some bad influence in his life. I don't know. The only issue I have with taking that perspective is I can look at the things that David did, and I can very easily see where he wasn't a very good example either. So to me, it's kind of hard to put all of it off on the mama. She may not have been a good woman, but there's a whole lot of times when David wasn't a good man either. He made some really bad decisions and definitely did not handle things as he should have in a lot of cases. But Absalom is, he's just a bad fella from the get-go. I mean, he's a bad dude. But in chapter 14, verse 1, it says, "Now Joab, the son of Zeruiah, perceived that the king's heart was toward Absalom." Joab's close to David. Y'all know he's his main military man, so he's close to him. And as time rocks on, he's able to tell that David's heart is towards Absalom, that he wants to see him. He's able to pick up on that. So what does Joab do? Well, Joab, you know, here's the thing about Joab. He turns out to be a pretty messed up individual as well. He really does, and we'll see more of that as we go on. But he comes up with this idea of how to get Absalom back. Joab sent to Tekoa and fetched thence a wise woman. Some lady there, her name is not given anywhere in the passage. All we know is what you get right here. She was in Tekoa, and she was a wise woman. She had some wisdom. So Joab doesn't seek out a fool. He seeks out somebody that has some wisdom. He wants that type of person. And he said unto her, I pray thee, feign thyself to be a mourner. That means pretend. The word feigned is to pretend. It's to be fake. It's not genuine. So he says, feign thyself to be a mourner. Just be a pretend. Put on an act. Play. Unfortunately, that's how a lot of people live their life every day. A lot of people just play act. Some of them play act on just one day out of the week. Monday through Saturday, they're genuine with everybody they're around. But on Sunday, they pretend to be something they're not. In church, they pretend to be godly and spiritual and love the Lord. And they know just what to say and how to say it and who to say it to and that kind of business. But then Monday through Saturday, they're a completely different person with the other people they're around. And obviously, those people pick up on that. They realize what's going on. We've got a lot of fakes, a lot of pretenders in the world today, people that are not real. Just depends on who they're around, how they're going to act. Do you know what I mean? Who they're around, their company, depends on how they're going to behave themselves. I think we ought to be the same tomorrow that we are today, don't you? That's how that ought to be. You ought not have one code of conduct for church or one code of conduct for the Christians and then another code of conduct for the people you work with or are around during the week. You ought to be the same then as you are at church. Amen? That's the way that ought to be. And if not, then, you know, you're a bad testimony. People pick up on that. But anyway, he tells her, feign thyself to be a mourner, and put on now mourning apparel, certain clothing that would be worn by people in mourning. And you see that even to some extent today. It's changed drastically. Obviously, it is much different than what we're reading here. But still, have you noticed when we have a funeral or something like that, that there's just certain colors that people think they're supposed to wear, certain clothes they think they're supposed to wear at a funeral? Have y'all noticed that down through the years? Oftentimes, people associate a funeral and mourning with what color? Black. I don't understand all of that. I don't know who it was and at what point in history somebody came up with the idea that if you go to a funeral, you need to wear something black. Well, it probably does have its roots back in things you read in the Bible, but I'm just wondering as far as the color, who decided that black ought to be the color? And I know that when you lose somebody, that is a time of sadness and mourning. I realize that, but here's the thing. If the person we lose is saved, love the Lord Jesus Christ, really and truly, we shouldn't go to great lengths to have a show of mourning. It should really be more a time of celebration, shouldn't it? Instead of trying to clothe ourselves in black and look all sad and black eyeshadow and you look like one of these, we call them people that dress in black all the time. Gothic, you know. You go to some funerals and everybody's, their hair's black, their clothes are black, their eyeshadow's black, everything about it. It makes me sad, you know, just seeing that. And I'm thinking, look, if we believe what we say we believe, and that really is what it boils down to, either you believe what you say you do or you don't. And if you believe that when a child of God dies and they go to heaven to be with Jesus Christ, and that according to the Scripture, they're far better off than any of us, why should we dress in black and be all sad and put out all the time? Why should we? We ought to see it more as a celebration. Not a time of sadness and sorrow. And again, there's always going to be a certain degree of mourning, and that's perfectly normal. But Paul does say, does he not? This is in the Bible, that those of us who are saved should not sorrow as those that have no hope. Isn't that what he says? And when we act certain ways, we project to people that we're no better than they are, that we don't have any better hope than they do. And listen, folks, if this Bible is true, those of us that are saved, we got a hope lost people don't have, don't we? And even in times of mourning and sadness, God expects us to watch our testimony. He expects us to be careful about the image that we project to other people during those tough times. And what he wants is for people to see that as saved people, we believe and know we have something that lost people do not have. So I think we need to be mindful of those things. You're always going to grieve and always going to have sorrow, but just be understanding that when people look at you, they're picking up on what you're projecting, okay? And keep that in mind. But anyway, he says, put on now mourning apparel and anoint not thyself with oil. You know, they would do that a lot. They would put on things. Oil obviously would shine up their skin and stuff like that. And when it was a happy time, they'd put the oil on and shine up. He says, don't do that. Don't do that. But be as a woman that had a long time mourned for the dead. Act like you have been in mourning for a long time. And come to the king and speak on this manner unto him. So Joab put the words in her mouth. What does that mean? He told her what to say, right? It says in verse 2 that the lady was a wise woman. The longer I read in this passage, the more I question her real wisdom. Because the way I feel about it is if you have some wisdom, you're not going to let people manipulate you. You're going to be your own man, your own woman, and you're not going to let other people tell you what to do. That's the way I feel about things. I tell Matthew all the time, son, you got to be your own man, and it doesn't matter what other people think. You can't be a puppet and let other people pull the strings for you. You got to be your own man and stand on your own two feet, whether people like it or not. And that's the way I feel about that. And just because somebody pressures you to do something or tells you to do something, like my mama told me a million times, you know, well, I'd say, well, so-and-so did it. You know what she'd tell me? Y'all tell me what she would tell me. Well, if they jumped off a bridge, would you know? Well, that's the thing. I mean, just because, which, by the way, that whole business, you know, kids would say, well, everybody else is doing it. First of all, that's a lie. Everybody in the world ain't doing it, okay? That's just a lie from hell is all that is. Everybody's not doing it. But the truth of the matter is we need to have such a conviction in our soul about what we believe that it wouldn't matter if everybody in the world was doing it. I'm talking about a real conviction. I'm not talking about this wimpy, pansy, fly-by-night thing. I'm talking about a real conviction down in your soul about what you believe. And you're willing to stand for that no matter what anybody else says about you. That's the way it needs to be. You take that stand. And even if it's such that everybody around you, which you're not going to probably be in many cases like that, but even if you are, and everybody around you is going a different way, but you know based on the Bible you're right, you know what you need to do? Stand your ground. And don't let them manipulate you. Don't let them force you to do things. Put words in your mouth. You stand for what's right. But this woman lets Joab put the words in her mouth. When the woman of Tekoa spake to the king, she fell on her face to the ground and did obeisance and said, help, O king. So she's come to the king and she's fixing to give her story that Joab told her to tell. And the king said unto her, what aileth thee? What's wrong with you? And she answered, I am indeed a widow woman, and mine husband is dead. My husband's dead, I'm not married. And thy handmaid had two sons, and they two strove together in the field, and there was none to part them, but the one smote the other and slew him. So she tells this story. She says, I'm alone, I don't have a husband. He's dead. And I had two boys, and they got put out one another out in the field, and they started fighting. And one of them killed the other, which would be murder. That's what that would be. One of them slew the other. So this is the story that she's putting before David. you can already, I would imagine, sort of see where she's going in this thing, the direction Joab wanted her to go, because that is somewhat similar to what has just happened in David's family, right? Absalom killing his brother. Now, there's some things in this story that is definitely not going to match exactly with what happened, but you can already tell kind of the direction this thing's going here. Verse 7, "And behold, the whole family is risen against thine handmaid. And they said, deliver him that smote his brother, that we may kill him for the life of his brother whom he slew. And we will destroy the heir also. And so they shall quench my coal which is left, and shall not leave to my husband neither name nor remainder upon the earth." She goes on to say, now that this has happened, everybody in the family is against me. And they've come and said, you need to hand over your other son to us so we can kill him because of what he's done. And again, Old Testament, that's the way it was supposed to be. But you have to keep in mind, none of this happened. This is just a story, okay? It's just a made-up story. That's all it is. But that's what they're saying. She says, my whole family is risen against me. Verse 7. And here we are back to that same idea. That wasn't true, again, because it's a made-up story. But what would you do? It's just a good practical thought to think about. Say you're in a situation somewhere down the line, and it's possible you may be in this, where even your family members don't agree with you, where your family doesn't support what you say you believe. What are you going to do? What are you going to do? You going to stand by what you say you believe, or are you just going to compromise so that your family will like you, so that they won't be mad with you? How are you going to respond to that? Maybe in a situation like that one day. Maybe I'm just crazy. I believe my commitment and dedication to the Lord Jesus Christ and the Word of God should exceed any relationship that I have with any person on this planet down here. And that includes my family, my immediate family, as well as my extended family and even my church family. He is to have the priority in my life above everybody else. And that's how it ought to be in the life of every Christian. You are to love him, right? With all of your heart, soul, mind, and strength. That means he has your affection above everybody else. That's the way that's supposed to be. Your affection, your commitment. So what would you do? What would you do? And there's all kind of scenarios that could play itself out. What would you do? But anyway, it goes on to say, and we're fixing not to quit for time. She says, and so they shall quench my coal which is left, and shall not leave to my husband neither name nor remainder upon the earth. Say, if they kill my only son that's left, since my husband's already dead, then he won't have any more descendants to carry on his name, is the idea. That's what she's talking about. Which in the Old Testament, if you study the law, God wanted that to happen, wanted it to be where you had offspring and you had people to carry on the family line. That's why you see in the Old Testament where, like, say, a man dies, well, his brother, one of his brothers was supposed to marry his wife. Y'all remember that? So that they could have some children and carry on that name if they didn't already have some children. So that's kind of what's being referenced here in the passage. She's saying if they kill my other son, since my husband's already dead, then that's it. His name's not going to go on. His name would just be wiped off the earth. Any questions about what we looked at here in the previous chapter or this chapter? Any questions? All right, we'll take a break.